Hello, and welcome back to Heard and Not Seen, a podcast from Barnardo's. In this episode of our oral history project, we're sharing a wonderful conversation between two women, Maureen and Irene. Both are women of colour, and both have spent time in the care system, but they are from two completely different generations. Maureen spent the first 16 years of her life in care, specifically in our very own Barnardo's Girls Village in Barkingside in East London. It was at a time when we were still called Dr. Barnardo's, and it actually doesn't exist anymore. This village was designed using something called the Cottage Homes Model, which believed that young girls could be best supported if they were living in small, family-style groups looked after by a house mother. The 60-acre site had 65 cottages, a school, a hospital, and a church, and provided home and training to 1,500 girls at its peak. Just like Maureen, Irene also spent several years in care, but she's a lot younger. She's 21 in this conversation and has just graduated from university. The purpose of this type of conversation is to give two people, one older and one younger, the chance to compare and contrast the shared life experience. It gives each of them an opportunity to swap some of the wisdom and knowledge they've gained on their respective journeys and allows us the chance to learn something too. In an effort to keep the authentic voice of the guests, this episode contains language that may be considered offensive to some listeners.
What was your background of coming into care?
Well, my mum had just was, I think, about 17, 18. And she came over from Jamaica with me in her tummy. Mm-hmm. I think quite far advanced when she got there into England. She came to an aunt who was already here. And, you know, she came to do nurse training nursing. I don't know if you know, you've heard about Windrush and those things. So I don't think she was one of the, kind of really the Windrush, but she was that era where they came to train nurses. They wanted nurses to come and do, I think, the dirty work in the hospitals, really. Mm. So she came and she wanted to train to be a nurse. But what people didn't know when she left was that she was pregnant. She hid it. I think... like my grandparents had some idea that she was, and she just hid it and said she'd lost it. And then I was born.
Did she come on her own? Sorry.
Yes, she did. She came on her own. And I think my uncle had already come over, actually, her brother, but he was in a different place. And she came, she stayed with my aunt, and out came, I popped along. And at 3 weeks, she took me down to Dr. Barnardo's in Ilford, Essex, and left me there. She said she couldn't manage whatever. I discovered that she did come and visit a couple of times. I think she came like twice. But it was quite difficult because she was a trainee nurse. She was very young, from Jamaica, didn't know this, you know. Yeah, so that's how I got into Dr. Barnardo's. 3 weeks old.
So you were in care from the beginning of your life, really?
Absolutely. I was in the nursery, and I think I was in the nursery for maybe a year or something like that, and then I was put into a cottage. And then I was lucky because I was in that cottage for a good many years. So
How long were you in care for then?
So I was 16.
Okay.
Yeah, I left when I was 16.
And this was...
I was pregnant with my first son, so then couldn't be in there anymore.
Yeah. Mm. When did you first become aware of race?
When we realised that we were different. I remember being in the village, maybe I was about 10 at this point. I was a proper tomboy. Everybody knew me in the place because I was one of the longest... serving members, I think, as it were.
Yeah.
And I remember these people coming into the village, and they must have thought it was a park or something, right? Because there's big greens, you know, that we could play on. Three big greens, and there was a few swings, and there was, you know, and we'd walk from each other's houses, but big spaces. So this family came and sat down in the middle of the green and started having a picnic. Now, it's private property. They weren't really allowed to do that. So me and my friends, we were outside, we were playing football, and we were, and the ball went onto their picnic, and they started calling us all these names. Hey, you black this and you black that, get off here and, you know, get out of here, go back to your own country, the favourite one. And we're like, hold on, love, you're on our land, this is our land, right? You're not supposed to be here. And this is private property. You know, there was mixed race kids, there was Indian kids, there was everybody, every, like, a lot of nationalities. We all sat down, we were all like brothers and sisters. We all just, even if we weren't in the same cottage, we were all very close and affiliated by the experience we'd had of actually being, not having our parents, being rejected by our parents or whatever the reason was, and being in this place. And we were like, wow, look at them calling us black this and black that. And da-da. You know, like, that's when we started to know that things are not all, you know, us being black and all together. Not everybody lived like us, like brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
But black was an issue somewhere along the line. No one taught us how to look after our hair and our skin, mm-hmm. that we needed to cream our skin. They didn't teach us how, you know, we just had this mop of hair. Like, I was quite lucky. My hair was quite soft, and I think they brushed on the top of it. But no one taught us to plait our hair or to cream our skin or, you know, you're a black child, so you need to, you know, so, you know, be treated in a different way, you know, with skin things and hair. No, that was never, ever discussed till I think we started to move outside the village a bit.
Yeah. I feel the same way. Growing up around white people, like, my whole life, not knowing the hair thing especially, I think we'd, like, had to teach ourselves, obviously, but, like, watching videos and stuff, seeing how to do it, and figuring out, like, how to brush your hair so it actually untangles and not, like, over the top, like you said.
Yeah, it's a difficulty, isn't it? I think what a saviour came to the village one time. We had one black auntie who came, and I think she was horrified seeing all these kids with these jigsaw puzzles on their arms and dry skin and, you know, walking around with nappy heads. And she, you know, there used to be a queue to her house because she suddenly started to teach us how to braid our hair, plait it, oil it, put stuff in it, do this, you know. And then, but before then, I'd gone to an outside school, but still, the only way I recognised my differences from other kids was that they'd come up to me and say, can I touch your hair?
Yeah.
Is your hair made of candy floss? Why are you brown? Why is it, you know, all these kinds of things. And I'd go home and say, why am I brown? Well, you know, why are they trying to touch my hair? It was quite dramatic. It was, and it made you ask a lot of questions, but questions that no one really answered, to be fair. It was a bit, you know, it was a bit traumatic. But they didn't know any better.
Yeah, now I guess they didn't know how.
They didn't, you know. So,
yeah. So how would you describe your own cultural identity?
Now, if, you see, when I was about 14, I discovered boys and I went out, funny, like with black boys, I used to go to parties and I loved the reggae music and I loved this. And I discovered West Indian food. And I wanted to know how to make it. My first try at making rice, I remember I was with my best friend, who we'd grown up together in the village, and her twin sister, and we tried to cook rice. And we put margarine in a pan and threw just rice in it and thought we were going to fry the rice. Mm-hmm. So we were very keen to find out about ourselves.
Yeah.
And we asked a lot of questions and we, and like went to, by then knew a few black people, and I used to go and watch things and watch them cook, try to learn to cook like that. And I identified strongly as soon as I knew, because by then, at seven, like when I was about nine, I think, probably I've got these dates wrong, but My grandmother started to write to me from Jamaica. They went and discovered my grandma. Mm-hmm. And so then I got these pictures of kids running around barefoot, and I was a bit scared because she wanted me to come, but I thought, I don't want to run around barefoot. you've got this image of these, you know.
Yeah.
I was very interested in it. And now I identify myself as I'm of West Indian. If people ask me where I'm from, I say Jamaica first, actually. I kind of feel like, might sound silly, I don't know if you identify with it, but I was conceived in Jamaica. My dad is Jamaican. I met my dad, fortunately. And so I identify as Black British, but really Jamaican. Jamaica is my heart. But I count myself blessed because I can identify with anything. And when it suits me, I can say, oh, I'm British.
Yeah.
You know, like, living here, I live in the Middle East, so I say British, but with Jamaican parentage, and they're all really excited about that. But, you know, that's how I identify as a Black woman. My kids have all been to Jamaica. They are proud of Jamaica. We love Jamaica, and we're proud of anything that Jamaicans do. Even if it's not so good sometimes, but that's how we identify. And that's what I brought my kids up to identify as well.
Yeah. How did you feel the first time you went to Jamaica? Was it kind of like going home or like?
Okay, so the first time I went to Jamaica, I'd already been to Canada. By then I'd met my mum. Not such a great experience, but my uncles and my aunts. And so when I went to Jamaica for the first time, I first went to Canada and stayed with my uncle, who begged me not to go to Jamaica. He said, oh, you won't manage. Oh, no. And I was determined I was going to Jamaica, but I was going to meet my grandma. So I was going to stay at my grandma's house. What I didn't realize was, oh my gosh, having been brought up in luxury, and in, it was kind of luxury, Dr. Bernard, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted for nothing. When we wanted, we asked. If we needed shoes, we got shoes. If we needed coat, we got a coat. Whereas my sisters, you know, my mum had to go and work for it first. You understand? So it was easy. So my uncle thought that I wouldn't survive in Jamaica. But let me tell you, when I got off that plane and the plane opened the doors and I felt, boom, the sun hit me, I just felt like I was at home.
Yeah.
I loved it and I embraced it. I was a bit scared of it. I was a bit wary of it because I didn't know it all. And I didn't, you know, I had a bit of trouble getting my head around what some people were saying sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I just identified with it and got on just great. I remember walking to school one morning. I was only a little girl, walked to school by myself, and this old woman spat at me and said, you black something or other, you nignog was one of them. Go back home. And I'm like, I was thinking, but I am home. What home are you talking about?
Yeah.
Like, why must I go home? I'm going to school. I never got it. Never understood that racism, that, you know, that they that poison that they came out with. I never got it. I was innocent of it until I got to about 14 and 15 and I started to fight back with it, I have to say.
But, yeah.
You know, until then, I never really understood it. You needed someone who really understood you and understood the hurt. You know, it's not easy to be without your parents when you're going out into society and you're seeing other people with their parents.
Yeah.
That was very difficult. But we now all sit and talk about it and talk about what our parents did and how we feel about it. And some people have made up with their parents. Some people never want to see them again. Some people were in there because they'd lost their parents, you know. But we all sit and have a great laugh about it and we all love each other to death. And we all, it's like, you know, when they say when you go into the Big Brother house, no, only the Big Brother people know about it. They experience it. It's a bit like that. We know what we went through. We know why we maybe have trouble forming relationships. We know why we don't trust people. And we know the hurt of not having your mum.
Yeah.
We know that. And I think, you know, that bonds us. We have a bond through that. And it's a bond that will never break. Only when we die, when one of us dies, we, you know, we're really sad.
Yeah, and, of course.
You know, but it's like losing a sibling to some extent that we maybe never had.
Of course, like you said, you grew up together and you've got that bond.
Mm. Yeah.
What was it like to be a person of colour in care?
It was hard at that point to identify with your colour, with people. I remember going in hospital to have my tonsils out, and one of the cleaners, the lady, she said to me, "So, where you live?" So I said, "I live in Dr. Bernardo's." She said, "Oh, you're a bad girl then."
Yeah.
And I was like, "No, I'm not a bad girl. I didn't do anything."
Mm.
I didn't know. So being a child of colour, when you're with white people, everybody looked at you. You know, white and black. Like, what's she doing with them? And then
trying
the head
to figure it out.
Yeah, it was difficult. And first when I was younger, I didn't realise why they were staring. And then I'd realise it's because we're black. And then I think I went through a stage of where I want to identify with being black. And I learned to do my hair. I tried straightening it. I tried doing this. I wore an Afro wig to school because I didn't know what to do. I didn't have an Afro
comb. Wig?
Yeah, I wore an Afro wig. I had a fight with this girl and she tore my wig off. My head was just like, not black, but just a mess underneath. All this kind of thing, you know, trying to find you, who you are, where you're from.
Mm.
But scared to go and find it because I didn't really have anyone to explain it to me.
Yeah.
One other black boy in my class, and he invited me, his mum invited me for dinner, and I had West Indian food and I loved it. And I'm like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for. Had no idea what I was eating, but knew this was me.
Yeah.
This is what I wanted, and this is what I want to know how to cook this and how to do this. You know, it took a while to fight and find out my identity, who I was. But I knew I was a black girl. And, you know, actually these people who kept calling me black this and black that helped push me towards that, because clearly I wasn't accepted as anything but a black girl from people I didn't know. So I needed to find what being a black girl meant.
Yeah, and embrace it, might as well.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Did your time in care influence your career goals or aspirations?
I think I was so lucky. I was lucky. I had good people looking after me who pushed me. I had a good social work. Like from I was young, they identified that I was quite intelligent, and therefore I was pushed out to. I was sent to an outside school. I didn't want to go. But they said, no, you know, in this school you won't learn. This is good for you. This will open you up and this will get you up. So I've always had people who have said, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And I think I've always had a bit of a will to succeed. And I think even though I did, you know, I'm making it sound all really nice, but I did go through some really hard and bad times and, you know, alone times. There were times when I realised, well, I haven't got any parents. Where's my family? Why haven't I got that? You know, my friends, and the area I lived was quite a wealthy one. So they all went off on their holidays. They all lived in nice big houses. They all had the best school uniforms. They all had this, you know, and it's like, and I didn't. And I wasn't allowed to go sleepovers because they had to have social workers come and look. So I think what it did for me, it didn't kill me, so it made me a bit stronger. A lot of the girls, when they left care, had babies, and I was the same. But it made me, when I was old enough to appreciate what they'd done for me, because I wasn't, even though I was pregnant with my son when I left there, like I had a social worker, again, who pushed me and said, right, you're going to, you know, you've got a child now, you know, you don't want him to end up where you ended up, so you need to do this, and you need to do that. And I listened to her, so I went to college, and I did whatever, and I did my teaching eventually. And it always made me want to give something back, though.
I agree as well. I think being in care and not having that direct support system, and, like, looking around and seeing your friends with like if something goes wrong, for example, like being at university, if you, if some, for my friend, if something goes wrong for you and you have to drop out, you have your family to go back to or something like that. And I think being in care pushes that kind of resilience in you, that you know that you have to do something for yourself because you don't have the same support system. But then in the other vein, I feel like when I was in school, because I went into care when I was 14, and I think I got a lot of support that I wouldn't have got otherwise. And I think that's the only reason really that I got my grades and got to do what I did. So I think it's kind of a, I don't know. But yeah, I think.
I know exactly what you're saying. Like I keep saying, what don't kill you make you stronger, right? You know, at some point you have to stand on your own two feet. And it's really difficult because I had four kids and I was trying to be in college, I was trying to be in uni, and there was none of that family support to help you. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult because, you know, I was with their father at first and then I broke up with their father. So then I'm alone with these kids and I had to push through, get through uni. You know, I said to you, I took one of my kids to Jamaica because I couldn't afford to take all of them. So I took turns to take them. Yeah. Your turn to go to Canada, your turn, but they all traveled. And I met, you know, and this was the only way I could do it, but I did it. So yeah, they've been all around the place. So you, what you have to do when you're in uni and things are tough, you have to find a way to look across those barriers and how can you work around it. And it can be lonely sometimes and it can be really tough and you think, oh my gosh, you know, if you've got your mum behind you or your aunts or your uncles or somebody saying, come on, you can do it, it's okay, it's tough at this time, come home, have a nice cozy sandwich with me. But if you haven't got that, it's tough. And at Christmas I used to feel it sometimes, really.
Yeah.
You know, you're just there and, you know, at that time I had my kids, but, you know, your kids should have grandparents and your kids should have these things. And you look and you think, oh, look at this. You're all, you know, it's just you. But you'll make your own. You'll make your own nest and you'll, you know, and it will be okay.
Yeah.
But it can be very tough and very lonely. But now you can contact me anytime when you get that tough.
Thank you. That's lovely. Mm. What advice would you give your younger self?
See, I try one thing, try in your life not to regret anything.
Yeah.
Try and look at it. This is how I look at everything. Like, you know, I've had good times, bad times, and I'm grateful that I was in Dr. Bernardo's. It gave me, even though it wasn't the best thing in my life forever, it saved my life probably.
Yeah.
You know? So I try not to regret anything in my life. My younger self, I'd probably say, don't be such a hothead. I was a right hothead when I was younger. But maybe that hotheadedness got me where I am today. I don't know.
I think that's an amazing outlook, really. If you can just look back and see that you've just grown, then I think that's pretty good.
Yeah, I just try and embrace it and not regret any of it. Just take your past and make it a stepping stone for your future and make it something positive for your future and make sure that if it's a bad past, if it's something that's not been good for you, that you don't repeat it with yourself and with your kids.
Yeah, I think that's great.
That's what I've tried to do. Okay. What do you want to do?
I don't really know. That's a big question.
How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 21.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I've just graduated from uni and I've got, pardon, sorry?
Congratulations and well done.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. I don't know really. I think when I started my degree's in sociology and I wanted to do something in like criminal justice, like probation work maybe, but I'm starting to figure out that it's hard to make those kind of decisions. So right now I just kind of want to see what happens. But I've got a job to teach English in China to little kids.
Oh, you go, girl. You know what I'm doing here? I'm in Oman and I teach English in Oman.
Oh, really? What's it like? Oh,
yeah, I'm teaching. I came as a deputy head here and then and now I'm bumming around really because I don't want to come back to the UK ever. Only because I've got kids there. But China, well done. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Do it. I would say, should I tell you something?
Yeah.
if you can travel, travel.
Yeah.
Right? Because travel is an education. I did it for the first time 5 years ago. I left the boys, never left them before in my life. And it's great. And you can travel around. And, you know, if you, once you do it, once you've done it for a little while, you can start traveling from China. Come to Oman. Come and see me in Oman if I'm still here. I'm a bit fed up with it now because of COVID and I haven't managed to see my boys for 9 months and that's a bit long for me.
Yeah.
But you can travel from wherever you're teaching. Enjoy it. While you're free, no kids, get to see the world as much as you can.
I think that's kind of what I'm planning because I feel like there's so much pressure to, you've got out of uni, now you need to start building your career. But I think I'd rather just, well, like you said, while I'm still young, just kind of do as much as I possibly can as in regards to like traveling and stuff. And just while I don't have any responsibilities, and then maybe it will help me figure out what I want to do. It's all about experience.
That's it. Yeah, you sound very sensible. Very like you've got your head screwed on. I think you know, us kids in care, we have to have our heads screwed on, and that's you know, that helps us make decisions that, you know, probably you're 21, it's a big decision to make without anybody, you know, really behind you. But do it, just do it. You'll love it.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, a rating and a review would really help us. Keep an eye out for more of these conversations, which we'll be sharing throughout Black History Month. For more information on the project and to learn more about Maureen and Irene, please visit the Oral History Project website at www.bernardos.org.uk/oralhistory. Thank you.